Let's travel to Rome on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We'll follow Monsignor Richard Sosman from East Moline to Rome today. Then Garrison Keillor will follow with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Monsignor Sosman, it's nice to catch you on a trip home.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, it's how often do you get back?
Two or three times a year. Mm-hmm. I started that when I first went. My mother was at home still on Campbell's Island, so I would come and be with her. Mm-hmm. And then she passed away in 2015, but it's hard to learn new tricks. So I come and I relax on the island and relax in the Quad Cities.
Let me ask you, take us from East Moline to Rome. How did that happen?
Well, I was working in Peoria and pastor in Princeville at St. Mary of the Woods for about 10 years. And Bishop Jenke came in one day to a meeting. And afterwards, he said, I need to talk to you. Can we talk privately? I said, well, sure. He said, there's been a call from Rome, and they'd like you to come and work. And there's some urgency, he said. So he said, I'll give you 36 hours to think about it. So I drove to the parish, and then I drove home to Campbell's Island and talked to my mother and my brother about it, you know, and it was somewhat bittersweet to go. I enjoyed my work in Peoria and my little church in Princeville, but Princeville is about halfway between Peoria and Kewaunee. And, mm-hmm. I decided if you get the call from the Holy See, from the Pope, it's, I mean, better say yes, I guess.
What are your duties in the Vatican City?
I'm at the Congregation for the Clergy, and we were the first congregation founded after the Council of Trent to enact all of that major council's reforms. And what hasn't been carved out from us, we still have. So we oversee all the priests and deacons in the world, and then we oversee property transactions, et cetera. So if a bishop wants to sell the seminary building for $3 million or over, they have to consult with us, so we make sure he's not selling something major at a cut rate to his Uncle Guido or something. Choice of names only coincidental.
I see.
So ministerial work.
Uh-huh. I need to ask a question that every one of us Protestants is pledged to ask every Catholic we meet. What do you think of the Pope?
Oh, well, he's a great great ball of energy. And I went to Marquette for college, and so I'm used to the Jesuits. Uh-huh. Once in a while, I feel like I have to translate what he's saying to regular speak. But
well, I would think his increased emphasis on pastoral priesthood must relate right to your work.
Yes, no, that's true. We had the Year for Priest in 2010, in which we encouraged people to pray for the priest, but also reminding priests to be pastoral, to be loving, to look on people as Jesus would. Mm-hmm. To find that balance, because it is a balance sometimes.
Has the problem, the pedophilia problem, run through your agency? Or?
No. Can I say fortunately it doesn't?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It goes through the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. Okay. We do have problems that we deal with normally, but not that particular one. Mm-hmm.
Well, you are fortunate then.
Personally, at least, should I say, at least, yes.
Oh, yeah. What prompted you to start writing?
Well, when I was a kid, with the Catholic schools sell magazines, subscriptions, and so one of the ones that we had to that I could count as a list, I put down Writer's Digest. Mm-hmm. And so I got a subscription to the Writer's Digest when I was just in high school. And then I always read the Atlantic Monthly and enjoyed that. Would scribble things here and there in my spare time. I got a master's in Spanish literature, so I've always been a reader and then a writer. with the most recent book that came out and some of the other things, it just takes discipline and also time to do that. And the thrust there was to try to speak practically about matters of faith to people.
But your book is called Reflections from Rome, and it's a series of small homilies, I guess. You said that most of them started out as blogs on the internet.
Yes, I was asked one Lent to publish a reflection every day for people on a Facebook group. So then I say Mass now at 7 at St. Peter's every morning, so I couldn't do this now, but then I wasn't doing that. And so I find it easiest to write in the morning. So I would start writing about 6:30 and finish up with a short reflection for the day before I left for the office about 8 o'clock. So that's how that came out. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted them to be practical, as I said.
I'm intrigued. I did my dissertation in grad school on Jonathan Edwards and spent a summer at Yale going through his manuscripts. And one of the things I discovered is that his most famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, with all those garish images of God is holding you over the pit of hell like a spider, you know, and you can drop in at any moment, that none of those exist in the manuscript. He never preached those. But somehow, when he turned from one medium, speaking directly, to writing, he felt the need to add all those garish images. Do yours change as they move from blog to print?
There was a little bit of editing. I didn't have a lot of time to change a lot of things, but I did, of course, change.
What would change?
I mean, well, I cleaned up the grammar and spelling, because at 6 in the morning, you're not always such your finest with that and trying to get something produced. Once in a while, I would change an image if I thought it was perhaps spoke to the day or the time when I wrote it. But then afterwards, I thought, well, people aren't going to really understand this. Once in a while, I became edited a little to become more descriptive about something in Rome or something that I knew most of the readers wouldn't have experienced in their everyday life. So with an effort to be practical.
The other thing that really intrigues me, every once in a while, words stand out at me, and words you've used every day seem really unusual, and you start thinking about them all day. And your title did that, calling it Reflections. I've spent my life playing the devil's advocate in and out of the classroom. So the minute I saw Reflections, I thought St. Paul threw a glass darkly.
Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
But Reflections is an interesting word here.
Yes. I write an essay for a cycling site every day during grand tours, and they started calling them essays. Mm-hmm. I've done that for about 10 years at least. But I thought, well, I can't call these essays because – well, it sounds a bit dry, and reflections I wanted to call people not just to read my experiences and my little thoughts afterwards, but to think about them so that they could reflect on them so they could
so
possibly.
So this is as much to get thinking going as to sort of solve it.
Yes.
Okay. Would you read one of your reflections?
Oh, sure, sure. I should say also that alliteration is never hurts.
Right.
Reflections from Rome.
Right.
This one is called, this one is about from growing up, called Toothpaste, Orange Juice, and the Morning Offering. My brother, sister, and I, in parentheses, the little family, the youngest three of us eight children, would rush around and put off until the last minute the two things that had absolutely to be done before we left the house to get to the bus stop. The last task before running from the house, which we dreaded, was drinking the large glass of orange juice, which my mother insisted upon to keep us healthy. We dreaded it because almost always, since we had put off drinking it, we had to drink our orange juice just after we had brushed our teeth, which we had also put off doing. Yuck. A task which came just before or after the orange juice, depending, was prompted by the question, "Did you say your morning offering?" If we hadn't, we would say at least the simple one. Oh my God, I offer thee every thought, word, and action of today. Please watch over me and help me to be good today. So much grace can be granted by God in response to our offering ourselves to God in sacrifice and penance. What is important is that we make this an offering, even in a perfunctory way, before or after orange juice, for example. We can, and of course do at Mass, offer ourselves as oblations as we lift up our hearts as sacrifices to the Lord. It does help, though, consciously to bring to mind our offering of our sacrifices to our Lord on a daily basis. Usually I advise people who are dealing with something extremely unpleasant to them, such as illness, family, conflict, etc., that hurts even to bring it to mind that they make this offering on a weekly basis at Sunday Mass, for example. In their prayer, they can offer to God cheerful acceptance of those burdens and the tremendous sacrifice it can be to live through them on a daily basis. This direction of your prayers and sacrifices can be made for whatever intention, whether it be for alleviation of that personal conflict, spiritual or physical healing, or the ever-present intention of world peace or the alleviation of hunger. So whether you are dealing with major difficulties or even the minor struggles and sacrifices of every day, don't forget to make your offering conscious so that you offer to God every thought, word, and action of today, even after your orange juice.
I remember that morning offering. It's a pretty familiar one. Let me ask you a question aside from everything. When back in the old days, when I was a seminarian, it was intimated that they were going to send me to Rome. And I dreaded that because I heard that all the classes were taught in Latin. And a classmate of mine went to Rome and came back, and he said he took a course in Hebrew, taught in Latin by a Spaniard.
Yes.
It got to the end of the first semester, and they had to translate something from Hebrew, just one phrase. And he said he went around on his knees begging for help. He just didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, if in the three-hour exam, if I can just get the first word. And he struggled and struggled and finally got it, rorate. He thought, that's the antiphon we sing every night. So he just wrote it up, got an A, went on vacation. And when he came back, he said, I can understand everything he said.
Oh, good.
Do they still teach in Latin?
Not all of the courses. Many of them now are taught in Italian. Mm. And so you get worldwide people coming and learning Italian so they can study. But there are a few – there are lectures certainly given in Latin, usually a simple Latin.
Mm-hmm.
More and more you get some of the classes or some lectures given in a multitude of languages.
I want to keep on Latin for a while, but a different kind of question. I take it from reading your book that you're somehow involved in the Latin Mass.
Yes.
I thought that was a dead issue long ago. But it is not, apparently.
I think these days it's seen more as a matter of taste, or if it nourishes
you.
So
is it coming back?
Well, it's always been kind of there, and
but it's sort of been pushed,
yes.
Right? But now is it being more encouraged?
I think it's somewhat organically. It is growing slowly.
Why? I mean, what makes Latin so popular, since most of the people can't understand?
Well, it's not necessarily just Latin. It's the old form of the ritual of the Mass, which has gestures, more gestures, and also it expresses more imagery and perhaps more repetitively than the current Mass does. Now, I of course say Mass in English or Spanish or Latin, but most of the Masses that are coming back that are in Latin are of the traditional form, because it nourishes people on a different level. Now, some of my students at the American Seminary, one of them was the head of the Charismatic Prayer Group, and he also thought it was important that he learn the Latin Mass so that he could use it if he needed to in his diocese. So it's seen as one of the options with the different forms of Mass that are out there.
I still remember, after all these years, almost all parts of that.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's. We also gave us a little book on conversational Latin back in the. And one only thing I remember is "Jacta in altera puer," which means "set them up in the other alley, boy."
My mother taught Latin in high school.
Oh,
in a little teeny Mennonite community of 1,200 people.
Oh.
Boy, I tell you, I stayed at Latin a long time, and I tried Spanish and I tried German. Nothing could get past the English in my head. I just would not work. You'd pick up a little phrase of this or that or something, a few words, but no.
You mean for conversational use, or?
Anagios.
Anagios. Well, but I know that you used to read Greek from the original, the old-time priests say. Oh, yes, you would always be reading Greek in the seminary. So. Maybe that's why you read it so much, because you couldn't get it to go through.
Well, it sounded like Greek.
You know? Oh, there we go.
But, Monsignor Sozman, I must say, it's a pleasure to see you and to have access to your book. We appreciate that.
Where can we get the book?
It's available from Roman Catholic Books, which is, I think, booksforcatholics.com. But an aunt of mine is a Lutheran, and they read it in their Lutheran ladies' reading group out in Omaha. So it's open for all faiths. But Roman Catholic Books is who publishes it.
Okay.
And then Amazon has it also.
Okay.
Yeah. Not electronically, unfortunately.
Right.
Are you working on another book?
Well, yes. I've got, actually three kind of information, but we'll see. Publishing is different now than it used to be.
It is incredibly different.
Oh, well, you, early morning or not, you keep writing, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, less frequently, but they're still there.
Okay.
And I have some sports essays that I've written for, as I said, for cycling, and also when I was in Princeville, I was kind of the chaplain to the team, the public school team there. They would come for our team meals, their team meals at our hall, and then I would give them a little fervorino ahead of time about being virtuous and, you know, strong, including Antigone, which I first saw at the Genesius Guild years ago.
Oh, my.
So I've got a collection of those types of things, too. Yeah.
Latin and Greek don't go away. They're still around.
That's true.
Well, once again, we thank you, Monsignor Richard Sozman, back on a visit home from the Vatican. And right now, we're going to go to Garrison Keillor to see what he has to say about the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Before we delve into the book bag rolled, I've talked before about the Publishers Weekly. I decided to, as I mentioned, take a subscription this year just to see what was going on. And my goodness, the size of this magazine every week.
There is too much going on.
There is. They have. And this particular issue that I picked up is the fall releases. Look at that.
I know.
I mean, that's how many pages? 153 pages of fall releases.
You know, and how can you possibly even read the reviews to know which of those 153 are?
But now, wait a minute. 153, fall review.
Yeah.
These are just children's books. Children's books. 153 pages.
Well, the statistic, and I've quoted that on here, I think, last year, just published books, not self-published books, there were 300,000 in the United States.
Yeah. And we're going to tell you a couple of times a year which of the books you ought to read.
And the chances of a book you write, even if it's published, ending up in a bookstore is 1%.
Yeah,
give or take.
That's true.
Unbelievable.
I find myself ordering more and more books from the bookstore because they don't have them in stock.
No, well,
I must read weird books, but
you just don't read the bestsellers and the summer books and the light.
No, I don't. I really don't. But I am hot for nonfiction books that'll tell me something solid about the world I'm in.
Fiction will tell you something solid about the world you're in, too, right?
It will.
Red Badge of Courage is a better story about war than anything Hemingway wrote, even though Hemingway's is based on his actual experiences.
That's true.
Because it freed from fact, it can tell the truth.
Well, and the way I learned to love Greek tragedy is because it tells you things about life, about the human being, and right in the beginning, when people were first becoming self-aware, those plays were teaching them what it's like to be a human, in that they showed what happens when people make choices and decide to do things and go all the way through. Then you watch that and you think, you're learning something about what happens to humans when they decided to step out and do something.
And Hamlet can do that better than history can.
Oh, boy, Hamlet. That's and King Lear. Hamlet and Lear, I go back and forth between the two of them. Which is the greatest play ever written? And I can never decide. About the time I'm convinced of one, the other one seduces
right.
me again. anything in the book bag, though, that you want to recommend?
I have a book that is absolutely astounding. 20 years ago, an Indian woman writer named Arundhati Roy, R-O-Y, wrote a book that made a huge splash, sold millions of copies. It was called The God of Small Things. I don't know if you even remember that title. But it won the Booker Prize, the first Indian woman writer to win the Booker Prize for the best novel in English that particular year. We've been waiting 20 years, but this past year, she's out with a new book called The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. And it is an incredibly sprawling, unruly portrait of modern India and its conflicts between Kashmir and Pakistan and the Hindus and the Muslims trying to kill each other off and move each other off. It is a picture of restless society. There's a great scene in which there is a protest in a central square with like 10,000 people there with 1,000 different protests, some protesting opposite things of the protest. I mean, it's just sprawling. But the main character is a transgender woman who ends up living in a cemetery because there's no other place for her to live. And slowly around her, there gathers other misfits, a blind imam, a Christian, an abandoned baby, et cetera, et cetera. In the middle of this turmoil, in this cemetery, they find some meaning. I love what sold me on the book is the dedication. It is dedicated to the unconsoled.
Ah, that is.
It is a great read.
Dedication alone is deeply moving.
Yeah.
What's the name and author again?
The Ministry of Utmost Happiness by Arundhati Roy.
That's a book worth examining.
It is worth examining.
And we hope you do that, and we hope as well you will join Roald and I again next week. We'll be back for another session on Scribble.